Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to tonight's Stages of Saving and Investing, Where Should You Be Now and How to Measure Your Progress teleconference. All parties are currently in the presentation session will be conducted at the moderator's discretion. At that time, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press 7 only once on your telephone keypad. I would now like to turn the conference over to Hal Lind.
Thank you very much, Tom. And welcome to today's seminar. It's the webinar for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society Lone Star Chapter. This is a part of the financial planning series, and this is our third out of the series of three. So stay tuned for a schedule that will come out in the future for the next set. The presentation today is by myself, Hal Lind, of the Lind Group over Morgan Keegan. It's called Stages of Saving and Investing, Where Should You Be Now and How to Measure Your Progress. What we're going to be talking about today is the fundamentals of starting and a starting place for making investment decisions, also a process to fall back on to assess your investment progress as you work towards achieving your investment goals. First, a little bit of background about Morgan Keegan. We were founded in 1969 in Memphis, Tennessee. We're a full-service investment banking and securities brokerage firm that serves the diverse financial needs of individuals and investors in the southern United States, corporates, and institutional clients throughout the U.S. and abroad. Morgan Keegan has 300 offices in 19 states. We're a member of FINRA, Financial Industries Regulatory Authority, and SIPC. SIPC, the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Morgan Keegan is a wholly owned subsidiary of Regions Financial Corporation. Regions Financial is one of the nation's largest financial corporations. That's our parent company, or they're the largest full-service provider of consumer and commercial banking and a full-service provider of trust product and services. Regions Financial Corporation has $142 billion in assets and over $27 billion in market capitalization. Regions serves over 4.4 million households from more than 1,900 locations in 16 states. Once again, my name is Hal Lind. I'm the managing director here with more than 10 years at Morgan Keegan and 15 years in the financial services and financial planning industry. I'm the manager of the Lind Group here in Houston, Texas. The Lind Group provides wealth management services to individuals through strategies and solutions. We do this by creating comprehensive plans to help clients accumulate, protect, and preserve, and finally distribute wealth in the most tax-advantaged way. Before we get into today's topic, as far as saving and investing in your progress, it's important to put everything out there on the table. Saving and investing goals may apply to everybody's needs here today, but there are many other wealth management issues that are important. I'm just going to hit the highlights before we get started. We've identified 13 wealth management issues in particular that must be addressed at some time in order to have the best chance of future financial soundness. Just going over the list briefly, obviously we talk about investments, also insurance, analyzing existing life and disability and long-term insurance. We look at liabilities, reviewing the terms, creditors and collateral, et cetera, qualified and non-qualified retirement plans such as IRAs and 401ks, stock options, business succession planning, durable power of attorney, gifting to children and descendants. We have charitable gifting during life and titling of assets, executors and trustees issues, a distribution plan at death, and also charitable inclinations at death to consider an alternative gifting strategies. Those are just some of the issues that are important to cover other than the topics that we are going over today. But let's get on with our presentation. We're going to start by discussing some fundamental investment concepts. Then we're going to review the investment options that are available to you and consider some general investment strategies. finally, we'll spend some time discussing how you might go about allocating your investment dollars and measuring, if you will, your investment success. In the end, that's my hope that this overview is going to assist you in thinking about your own investment needs and how we may help or you may help yourself in determining your savings and investing goals and also measuring your progress. So to get started, I'm going to just pose a question out there. What does investing mean to you? Now, some may associate investing with speculating or even gambling on the volatile or uncertain value of assets in the hope of attaining potentially higher returns, for example, trying to time the market in order to make a quick profit. Now, others may see investing as more of a long-term goal, methodically and effortlessly to save for the future. In fact, investing is a little bit of both. It involves a certain amount of risk. It also involves the potential growth of your money over time. Consider investing as a carefully planned and prepared approach to managing and accumulating money, because investment planning is about the discipline, patience, but it also doesn't have to be difficult. Now, it's an important concept to understand when it comes to investing the impact of inflation. This is real important when we look at our measuring sticks. Inflation has the effect of reducing the purchasing power of your dollars over time. And according to the U.S. Department of Labor, the average annual rate of inflation over the past 20 years has been approximately 3%. And at 3% in annual inflation, something that costs $100 today would cost approximately $181 20 years from now. So let's say you have $200,000 stashed in your mattress, and assuming a 3% annual inflation rate, that $200,000 today, just over $108,000 worth of goods and services is what that'll buy in 20 years. And that same $200,000 will give you the same purchasing power of only $60,000 if we look 40 years down the road. So this means that your investments aren't keeping pace with inflation, you're actually losing purchasing power each year if you keep your money in a mattress. It also means that the real rate of return of your investments may actually be less than you think, something you'll have to take into account. Inflation has a general effect of reducing the real value of your investments over time, but compounding has exactly the opposite effect. Anyone who has a saving account understands the basics of compounding. The funds in your saving account earn interest, and that interest is added to your account balance. So the next time interest is calculated, it's based on the increased value of your account. In effect, you earn interest on your interest. Now, many people, however, don't fully appreciate the impact of compounding. Let's say you invest $5,000 a year for 30 years. After 30 years, you will have invested $150,000. Yet, assuming your funds grow at exactly 6% each year, because of compounding, after 30 years, you'll have $395,000, more than twice. The rule of 72 is a quick way to help you estimate how long it'll take an investment to double in value through compounding. Now, you're going to do this by just dividing the number 72 by the rate at which the investment will increase in value, and the result will be the number of years it'll take for your investment to double. You know, for example, if your expected annual return for an investment is 3%, it should take you about 24 years for your investment to double in value. You can also use that rule of 72 to estimate the rate of interest that you need to double your investment within a given number of years. Just divide 72 by the number of years. And an example of that is, in order to double your investment in value in 4 years, doing the math, you'll need an annual rate of return of around 18%. So when do we start investing? The sooner you start investing, the better. The more time your investments have for potential growth, and waiting too long can make it very difficult to catch up. For example, if you invest $3,000 every year starting when you're 20 years old, and you have accumulated almost $680,000, that's assuming a 6% annual growth rate, and by the way, we're not taking taxes out of this, you will have that $680,000 by the age of 66. But if you wait till the age of 35 and start investing that $3,000, the same $3,000 annually, you will have accumulated, instead of the $680,000, only $254,000. And if you wait until the age of 45, it's even worse. As you can imagine, you'll only accumulate $120,000 by the time you're 66 years old. It's never too late. Don't be discouraged. I'm just simply trying to illustrate the importance of acting sooner than later. Now, we've talked about this in prior sessions, talking about goals and time horizons. It's the first step in any investment plan, and that is to identify your goals. What are you investing for? Now, many of us are investing to accumulate funds for retirement or for a child's education or for other uncertainties that are in our future. Others are for shorter-term goals, perhaps a down payment on a home or a car or some needed home repairs. And others still invest just to build up their dollars and their nest egg for unanticipated financial needs, like an illness, an accident, job losses, for example. Now, of course, you may have all of these things as investment goals or something else that I haven't even mentioned yet. But if you have multiple goals, think about how you're going to prioritize them. Start off by writing them down. Once you've identified and prioritize your investment goals, consider now your time horizon with each goal. Now, in general, all else being equal, the longer your time horizon, the more aggressively you may be willing to invest. That is, investments that carry more risk. And the reason we do that is because investments that carry more risk should also offer the greater potential for return. They're going to tend to be more appropriate for those longer-term investment horizons than those with a short-term investment horizon. Now, this is why. The longer the investment horizon, the more time you'll have to recover in the case if you have any investment losses. Now, the world of investing is very subjective. The investment plan that's right for you depends largely on the level of comfort that you have when it comes to risk. Now, you can't completely avoid risk when it comes to investing, but it is possible for you to manage it. There's two aspects of risk tolerance to consider here. It's the capacity of your investment plan itself to absorb the losses. And then the second part is how comfortable are you personally with risk? Now, the first aspect we can quantify. The more flexibility your investment plan has when it comes to potential loss, the more risk your plan can tolerate. For example, as we've discussed, a long investment time horizon may allow you to take on more risk than a short time horizon. Now, the second aspect I just mentioned, how comfortable are you personally with risk, it's more of an emotional measuring stick and depends on many factors, including your objectives, your life stage, your personality, your investment experience. Some investors are comfortable with a high degree of risk, and others can tolerate only a minimal amount of risk. Your own individual risk tolerance is a very important factor in deciding which individual investments are appropriate for you, as well as how your investment dollars should be allocated among the different asset classes. Investors are typically grouped into three different categories. This for the purpose of only discussing risk tolerance. We have those that are aggressive, and that would be a person who has a high degree of risk tolerance. The second category would be moderate, those willing to accept some degree of risk, and then conservative, those who are risk averse. Now, when it comes to investing, there's a direct relationship between risk, we've been talking about, and return. That is, in general, the potential for return increases. Well, guess what? So does the level of risk. Or stated another way, the less risk an investment has, the lower the potential for return. So, for example, putting your money into a bank CD may have little risk, but it also offers less potential return than, say, purchasing common stock. Now, this is true for investment portfolios as well as for individual investments. So the more aggressive you are as an investor, the more risk you may be willing to take. That means more risk means a greater potential return. But also, with that, as I mentioned before, comes a greater chance of loss. Now, conversely, the more conservative you are as an investor, the less risk you're generally comfortable with. Well, then the less risk means the lower potential returns, but also the less likelihood of loss as well. Now, this is known as the risk-return trade-off. Very important. As much as I'd like to, you know, we really can't have it all. There is a relationship between growth, income, and stability of our investments, and when we move closer to one, we automatically move away from the other. It's a dilemma that all investors face. Now, the key here is to try to maximize your returns at a level of risk that we're comfortable with. Now, there's several different general categories of investments to choose from, and countless of specific investment objectives or options with each category. Now, we're going to discuss a few of these real briefly. First are cash alternatives, then bonds, stocks, and we have a broader category called other investments. We also have funds that pool your money with other investors' money, such as mutual funds and exchange-traded funds. Now, before we start talking about investment options, let's take a moment to clear up a couple misconceptions. Some of you may think your 401k plan, as well as your IRA, is an investment. Well, quite frankly, they're not investments. 401k plans are tax-advantaged vehicles that hold individual investments. The same goes for the IRAs or 529 plans, Coverdell ESAs, or any other type of investment shell. Think of these as tax-advantaged vehicles like buckets that can be filled up with individual investments. Individual investments that are held in each of these vehicles now get different tax treatment than instruments that are held outside of these vehicles. Now, we're not going to discuss the tax treatment of investments at all today. However, it is an important subject, especially since the tax treatment of long-term capital gains and qualifying dividends is currently very favorable. So since you'll need to understand how different investment options are taxed to make good decisions, you should discuss this with a financial planner or a tax professional. Okay, the first one on the list, cash alternatives. They're relatively low risk, they're short term, they're fairly liquid, and in other words, you can convert them quickly into cash if you need to. Now, you might use cash alternatives, for example, to provide you with something relatively to provide relative stability. Also, cash alternatives are good to maintain a ready source of cash for emergencies or other uncertain purposes. Maybe cash alternatives serve as a temporary parking place for assets until whether you decide to put your money in an investment such as a longer-term investment or not. Now, a few examples of some cash alternatives include certificates of deposits, CDs, money market deposit accounts, money market mutual funds and U.S. Treasury bills. They're also known as T-bills. Now, each of those options offer different rates of return, and varying levels of liquidity means the availability to turn them quickly into cash. Now, also some cash alternatives such as bank CDs and deposit accounts may offer FDIC insurance, but others don't. Make sure you understand the type of protection that's available with each one before you invest. The advantages of investing in cash alternatives are evident. You see, you receive a reliable, predictable amount of earnings. We'll call that interest. And it's an easily tapped source of funds with little risk to your principal, which means the value on a day-to-day basis shouldn't fluctuate or not fluctuate very much. But the big trade-off here is that the return you receive on these investments is going to be relatively low compared to the potential return offered by other investment options. In fact, the possibility exists that the return on those investments, these cash investments, will not be sufficient enough to actually keep up with inflation. And now, if that's the case, you'll actually be losing purchasing power over time. Now, bonds are essentially loans, which we call them debt instruments. You, the investor, will lend money to a government, to the government or a corporation. The interest rate or the coupon rate, which can be fixed or floating, that means it either stays the same or it changes, is set in advance. And interest payments are generally paid semi-annually, twice a year. Bonds are issued in denominations as low as $1,000. And in addition to a set interest rate, the maturity date is also generally fixed. The range is usually from 1 year to 30 years. However, bonds don't need to be held to maturity. They can trade just like other securities. Once issued, they become a trading vehicles, but most investors do hold them to maturity. Now, because you can buy or sell bonds in the open market, this also means that bonds fluctuate in price, which means that they either sell above or below their face value. If interest rates rise now, for example, new bonds and investment options are offered with higher interest rates as interest rates rise. But the existing bonds with lower fixed interest rates become less appealing to the general market. So when interest rates rise, existing bonds generally decrease in value. But in contrast to that, when rates fall, when interest rates are going down, existing bonds generally increase in value. Now, the longer a bond's duration, which means the longer you hold a bond to maturity, the more volatile these price swings are going to be. Now, the most common types of bonds include U.S. government securities, U.S. government agency bonds, municipal bonds, and corporate bonds. U.S. government securities are backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government and therefore carry a minimal amount of risk. We also have already talked about U.S. Treasury bills. And other than Treasury securities, they're going to include things like Treasury notes, Treasury bonds, and once again, these pay interest two times a year, semi-annually. You can also invest in bonds that are issued by agencies owned or sponsored by the U.S. government. Now, although these agency bonds are considered low risk, they generally aren't backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. It's an implied guarantee. An example of these would be a Ginnie Mae, a Fannie Mae, or a Freddie Mac bond. Now, municipal bonds are issued by local governments of states, cities, or towns. Specific authorities like a state transportation authority may also issue bonds. The next category of bonds would be corporate bonds. They're issued by private companies. But the volatility of these bonds depends on the companies that issue them and can range from something that was very stable to something that was highly volatile. You might have heard of something called high yield or even junk bonds. Some corporate bonds are even convertible and can be exchanged for shares of company stock. You can also purchase zero coupon bonds that are issued at a discount below face value, which means you're going to pay a discounted price and get no interest, but at the bond's maturity, you receive the full face value of the bond. A real quick example, you might pay $600 for a five-year, $1,000 zero coupon bond, and at the end of the year, at the end of the five-year period, you would receive the $1,000. That is a zero coupon bond. So what are the pros and cons of bonds and your investment choices? Take a quick look. Bonds aren't as safe as cash alternatives, but they're also not as, I guess, glamorous, if you will, as stocks or commodities, but they're an important component of most investment portfolios. They can provide, that is bonds, a steady and predictable stream of income through interest payments for as long as you hold them. In addition, the income from interest payments is typically higher than the cash alternatives interests. Bonds are generally considered lower risk investments because bonds are legal debt obligations. Corporations must pay interest to bondholders before they pay dividends to shareholders. Furthermore, in the event of a corporation declaring bankruptcy or if they dissolve, it's obligated to pay bondholders before stockholders. And of course, securities are issued by that are issued by the U.S. Treasury Department, the U.S., the United States of America. They're backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. However, all bonds do carry risk. That's an important point. And some bonds, for example, the high yield or the junk bonds, carry a great deal of risk. All right. Bonds also can help you diversify your investment holdings. They tend to move in the opposite direction of your stock holdings. So as stocks relatively in principle go higher in value, in general, you'll over history we've seen bond prices go down. So it's an uncorrelated asset. Now with a bond you can lose money. We're going on the disadvantage side here. If the issuer fails to make an interest payment or is unable to repay your original investment, the principal. Bonds can also lose market value if the creditworthiness of the issuer declines. Now, for example, if the issuer begins having financial difficulties or if its bonds are downgraded by the ratings services, your bond can go down in values just like you can see the value of an equity or a common share decline in value. The type of risk associated with this is really more with the corporate bonds and less with the Treasury securities that are backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. Now, a lot of bonds are issued with a fixed interest rate. The general interest rates do fluctuate, so will the value of the fixed rate bonds. If interest rates drop, new bonds and investment options issued will offer lower interest rates, and the market value of existing fixed rate bonds are likely to increase. The flip side of that is an increase in interest rates will generally cause a drop in the value of existing bonds. We just mentioned that. However, not all bonds have fixed interest rates. Some bonds have floating rates of interest, and they will tend to fluctuate less in value when interest rates change than bonds with the fixed rates of interest. And finally, because bonds have a relatively lower risk than other investments, such as stock, they also tend to carry relatively lower rates of return. Now, when you buy common stock, you're actually purchasing a share of ownership in that business. The greater number of shares you own, the higher percentage of ownership you have in that company. Investors that purchase stocks are known as the company's stockholders or their shareholders. Your percentage of ownership in a company also represents your share of the risk taken and the profits generated by the company. So if, for example, the company does well, the share of your total earnings will be proportionate to how much the company's stock you own. Now, the flip side of that, of course, is that your share of any loss will similarly be proportionate to your percentage of ownership as well. Now, beyond that, depending on the company, the types of shares that you have do carry other benefits. Now, specifically, you may be entitled to dividend payments. They're generally received in either cash or in additional shares issued. You also have the rights to capital gains payouts, voting rights, and some other corporate privileges. For example, common stockholders have the right to vote for candidates for the board of directors and other important company issues. Now, if you purchase stock, you can take money in one of two ways. First, corporate earnings may be distributed in the forms of dividends. Those are usually paid out quarterly. Second, you can sell your shares if the value of the company's stock has increased since you purchased it. You make a profit. Of course, if the value of stock has declined, you will lose money. Generally, corporations issue two types of common stock, or just if two types of stock, if you will. There's common stock and preferred stock. Now, common stockholders have many rights, including the right to vote. However, the common stockholders are last in line to claim earnings and assets of the company. They do receive dividends at the discretion of the board of directors, and only after all other claims and profits have been satisfied will the common stockholders get paid. Now, there's another type of stock. It's called preferred stockholders, and they're generally given priority over holders of the common stock when it comes to paying dividends and to the claiming of assets. However, preferred stockholders do not receive all of the privileges of ownership given to your common stockholders, including the right to vote. Preferred stockholders typically receive a fixed dividend payment. That's also usually received on a quarterly basis, which is every 3 months. And for preferred stockholders, there is less return potential for common stockholders. There's also less risk. The common stockholders benefit more when the company does well, but they may lose more when the company does poorly. Stock is commonly categorized by the market value of the company that issues the stock. Now, here's an example. Large cap stocks describe shares issued by the largest corporations. Other general categories include the small cap stocks, the mid cap stocks, and also micro cap stocks. Now, stocks also commonly classified according to characteristics of a company and expectations. There's a few different categories. Here's an example. There's growth stocks. Growth stocks are usually categorized by the earnings that increase faster in rate than their industry average or the overall market's average. Now, these are often new or fast-growing industries and frequently have the potential to give shareholders returns greater than those offered by stocks of company in, say, older or more established industries. Growth stocks are among the most volatile, though, classes of stocks, which we mentioned earlier, will have a significant risk, that risk for losses. There's also value stocks. Value stocks are characterized by companies that are selling at low multiples of a company's sales or earnings, or a low multiple of their book value. You hear these referred to as companies that are selling cheap. Now, there's also income stocks. They offer higher dividend yields than the average market yields on stocks. And there's blue chip stocks, and these are usually stocks of large and well-known companies with good reputations and strong records of profit growth. Those can also pay dividends as well. Need to mention real quickly, American Depository Receipts, ADRs. These are negotiable instruments created to represent shares of stocks, sometimes bonds, that are in foreign or non-U.S. companies. Going to go over the advantages and disadvantages of the stocks. Advantages and disadvantages of investing in stocks depends largely upon the stock or the type of stock that you are choosing. In general, though, stocks offer a greater potential for return than do bonds or cash alternatives, but historically has been particularly true for long periods of time. Now, with stocks, you actually own a share of the company, and therefore you have ownership rights, which include, as we mentioned, voting rights. You can invest in stock that has a history of paying regular dividends, and you can also invest in a stock that has potential to appreciate significantly in value. Stocks, mind you, are very easy to buy and sell. Now, of course, if the company you invest in performs poorly, it may not even pay dividends, even if it had regularly paid dividends in the past. More importantly, poor performance may result in your shares losing value. In fact, your shares can lose value simply because they're subject to the general volatility of the entire stock market, which has experienced sharp declines in the past, and sometimes in the not-so-distant past. Now, this volatility means that the risk of losing principal is greater with a stock than with bonds and your cash alternatives. It also means that common stocks or stocks in general may not be appropriate for short-term investment timelines. We'll go back to that first couple of slides talking about your investment goals and your investment timelines, unless you have a higher tolerance for risk or the ability to make up losses in a different fashion. Other investments, cash alternatives, bonds, and stocks. There are three major investment categories, but there's many other options that include real estate. There's commercial and residential, REITs, real estate investment trusts. There's stock options, the option to buy or sell a stock at some point in the future, and also futures and commodities, which amount to speculating on the future value of something like gold, sugar, or wheat, or oil. Some also put in this category collectibles such as antiques, fine arts, or anything that may appreciate in value over time. But because this is an investment basics discussion, and we're talking about specifically saving and investing and measuring our progress, these may not be appropriate these are not appropriate for this discussion and may not be appropriate for you. Be more than happy to discuss them at a different point in time. So let's move on to mutual funds. They also represent another way to invest in stocks, bonds, and also these cash alternatives. And the principle behind a mutual fund is pretty simple. Your money is pooled with the money of other investors. It goes into a fund, which the fund then invests in certain securities according to a stated investment strategy. Then your fund is managed by a fund manager who reports to a board of directors. And by investing in the fund, you own a piece of the total portfolio, which could include anywhere from a few dozen to hundreds of securities. This provides you with both a convenient way to obtain professional money management and instant diversification, which would be more difficult and especially expensive to achieve on your own. Every mutual fund does publish a prospectus, and before investing in a mutual fund, please get a copy, read it carefully, and review the information it contains, such as the fund's investment objectives, the risks, the fees, and the expenses. Also, carefully consider those factors as well as others, like how these investments match your goals and your time horizons before investing in those. Now, we've discussed three major categories of investments: cash alternatives, bonds, and stocks. Many mutual funds limit themselves to just one of these categories, and commonly named and classified according to their investment style or objective, like a large cap growth fund or a short maturity government bond fund. The funds that invest solely in cash alternatives are generally called money market funds. Now, funds that invest in stocks are called stock funds. Stock mutual funds can also be classified on the size of the companies. We mentioned those of the companies they invest, like large cap, mid cap, small cap. But of course, there's many other types of mutual funds. For example, there's funds that invest in both stocks and bonds. These are generally called balanced funds. Now, in fact, these are mutual funds that fit along the risk return spectrum. Now, international funds, which seek investment opportunities outside the United States, are another example. Now, an actively managed fund is a fund where the fund manager uses their knowledge to research actively in order to buy and sell securities in an attempt to beat some benchmark, something that the portfolio manager is being measured against. A passively managed account is called an index fund. They typically buy and hold most or all of the securities that represent a specific index, for example, the S&P 500 index or the Dow. Some will try to mirror the returns of the NASDAQ. But the objective of an index fund is to obtain the same rate of return as the index that it's mimicked or the index that it's named after. Diversification. Now we're talking about mutual funds. There's a lot of advantages and disadvantages. Our discussion today is not necessarily about all of the disadvantages and advantages of mutual funds, but they are worth going over quickly. First, the advantages: diversification, professional management. You can invest also small amounts of money to get a large amount of the diversification, many more companies that you can buy with a smaller investment. And they also offer liquidity. They're easily purchased and sold. The disadvantage is the value of your shares can fluctuate, and they generally do on a daily basis. A portion of your fund dollars is tied up in cash for the liquidity needs also of the fund manager. So not all of your money is actually invested. Now, there's also the potential for a tax inefficiency. When you own a mutual fund, you own a pool of assets, as so do all the other investors in that particular mutual fund. The investments inside that mutual fund already have either gains or losses in each of the individual investments in that fund. So when the fund manager sells any of those investments, that will trigger either a loss or a gain, depending on when he bought those securities. That loss and gain is then distributed to all the current shareholders, which could put you in a position to where your mutual fund could go down in value 1 year, and you could still be issued a capital gains tax bill at the end of the year. Also, the last disadvantage is mutual fund fees and expenses can be higher than that of buying the individual investments all on their own. Lastly, we had mentioned the exchange-traded funds. Most exchange-traded funds are based on particular indexes, like we mentioned the S&P 500, the Dow Jones, and possibly the NASDAQ. Exchange-traded funds are passive management funds, which, by the way, if they're passive, means lower fund costs. They also can be traded throughout the day instead of at the end of the day like a mutual fund. So mutual funds are only bought and sold at one time of the day, but an exchange-traded fund can be bought at any time when the market is actually open, just like a stock. They also could provide some tax efficiencies as well because of the way that they trade. Dollar cost averaging. Now, what is the advantage here? If you invest the same dollar amount at regular intervals over time, this is what's called dollar cost averaging. So the market is going to be going up and down, but it doesn't matter at a specific period in time, over time, if you purchase investments on a schedule, if you will, that's called dollar cost averaging. So when prices are low, with the same dollar amounts invested, you actually are able to buy more shares, but fewer shares when prices are high. The average cost will be lower than the average market price per share during your investment time period. It's just a matter of math. An example, if we go through a period of time and we buy $30 worth of, we buy, let's say, $300 worth of stock each month, and we'll put a goal in there of your child's education, and we're going to put $300 a month in. But because you invest the same amount each month, you automatically buy the more shares when prices are low and fewer shares when prices are high. And over time, you'll find your average cost per share really is actually less than the average market price per share. If you are viewing this online, you can see our hypothetical, making five investments January through May. We're able to get prices at $30 a share. We're looking at the price per share for an investment. Then we're able to buy shares at $10 a share, 20, then 15, then 25. That's a lot of volatility, by the way, if this is an investment that you own. We'll divide that by the five different periods that we purchase stock in this example. That comes out to $20 a share. With the same illustration, the average of the stock over that period of time is actually $22. So by dollar cost averaging, you can, not always, but you can end up with a lower cost basis for your entire investment. We're going to go to the asset allocation considerations. We've talked about saving. We talked about investing, not only investing, but we got into a little bit of detail about the different types of investing. But things you need to consider in asset allocation, it's important to know, is diversification, risk tolerance, what your time frame is, your personal financial situation, also what your liquidity needs are. There's three examples I'm going to give you, and we talked in the beginning of this conversation about the different types of investors. Well, let's see what these three different types of investors' portfolios will typically look like. This is your measuring stick. How does your portfolio measure up to that of these investors? First, we will have the conservative investor. A conservative investor will look at a conservative asset allocation. Our example here would be 25% in stocks, 25% in cash and cash alternatives, and 50% in fixed income or bonds. Now, the focus here is in some growth, but in the preservation of your capital or the preservation of your original investment value. The next is a moderate investor. Do you fit in here? 10% cash alternatives, 40%, remember the other one was 50% in bonds, this is 40% in bonds, and then lastly, 50% in stocks. A moderate asset allocation model is going to tend to balance predictable income with some potential growth. And lastly, is this you? It's a lot. Most folks don't view themselves as aggressive, but this is what an aggressive measuring stick looks like. Around 10% cash alternatives, only 15% in bonds, and 75% in stocks or stock mutual funds. An aggressive asset allocation model will tend to focus primarily on the potential growth. Now, how can you get help? There's many things online. What we can tell you today is, consider getting the help of a financial professional. They can help you determine your investment goals, your timelines, your risk tolerance, create an asset allocation model, select the specific investments, and finally, to manage and modify and monitor your investment portfolios. Now, at this time, I'd like to welcome each of you to join in on any questions and answers. It's been my pleasure to speak with you today. I'm going to turn it quickly over to Tom, our moderator.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone that if you would like to ask a question, please press 7 only once on your telephone keypad. Once again, if anyone would like to ask a question, please press 7 on your telephone keypad.
With that, I'd like to thank everybody for joining in today. Once again, if you have any questions, this material will be made available to you from the Houston office of the Lone Star chapter of the MS Society. It'll also be posted on the website. We invite any questions into our office as well, and everything is, as expected, kept 100% confidential, and all consultations are at no cost. I'd like everybody to always have a plan and have a great day.
Once again, I would like to thank everyone for attending today's teleconference. You may all disconnect.